My name is Mike Satz, and I'm happy to welcome you to today's City Club of Boise program, The Confluence of Race and Gender for Women of Color. I am a City Club of Boise board member and forums committee member. I'd also like to wish my fellow veterans a happy Veterans Day today. And also, because I have the video and the mic, go Navy. All right. So, attendees, I want to welcome our radio listeners who will be joining us at a later date via Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 FM and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. Today's forum is available in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I would like to take the time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens, and a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors, AARP of Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climate Tech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mine Development. City Club of Boise also receives grant funding from the Idaho Humanities Council. Thanks to our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, Idaho Statesman, and Idaho Public Television, and to our university partners, University of Idaho and Boise State University and Northwest Nazarene University. Our sincere thanks goes to those of you who support City Club with membership or a donation during registration. Finally, I'd like to let you know that there is a program next week, part of our series of conversations about racism, where we'll discuss the impacts of redlining on health, wealth, and housing with a very knowledgeable panel. Please visit cityclubofboise.org to register. Now, on with today's program. Following our panelists' opening remarks, there will be an opportunity for them to respond to your questions. You can use the Q&A function of Zoom, just type in your question, or you can email it to morgan@cityclubofboise.org, and it will be provided to today's moderator, Professor Shakira Sanders. And now, I would like to introduce Professor Shakira Sanders. Shakira Sanders became the first African-American and second person of color to achieve the rank of full professor at the University of Idaho College of Law. And I'd like to add also on a personal note, she is a fantastic colleague. Professor Sanders teaches courses related to U.S. constitutional law and criminal procedure. She previously coached or co-coached the national moot court competition teams in Boise and in Moscow. She serves as faculty advisor for the ACS and the ACLU student law groups. She previously served as faculty advisor for the Idaho Critical Legal Studies Journal and the Public Interest Law Group. Professor Sanders, my voice is now falling apart, so why don't you take it here from here?
Thank you, Professor Satz. And I want to say, that our audience should know that you are the founder of the Idaho Critical Legal Studies Journal. And I'd like to thank you for your service in the Navy. I am so pleased to join you today as your moderator for this discussion with two fantastic women, Irene Ruiz and Gayla Thomas Dabney. I'm going to introduce you to Irene Ruiz first. She is an organizer at the Idaho Organization of Resource Councils, where her goal is to connect with the Latinx community in Idaho to increase a diverse membership base, as well as identity leaders. Irene is also a co-founder of Podare Idaho. She serves as a bilingual community organizer for the Idaho Organization of Resource Councils, and she serves with me on the board of the directors of the ACLU of Idaho. Irene is the daughter of Mexican immigrants, and she grew up in Hazleton, Idaho, where she worked in the fields with her family. Irene went on to receive her Master's of Arts in Hispanic Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and her Bachelor of Arts in Spanish from Boise State University. Irene currently lives in Boise, and she enjoys spending time reading, traveling, running, and with her family and friends. Gayla Thomas-Dabney is the Regional Director of Diversity and Inclusion at the Western Region, for the Western Region at St. Alphonsus Health Center. Gayla Thomas-Dabney serves as the Director of Equity, or previously served as Director of Equity and Inclusion for 3 years at Boise State University. Gayla served 24 years in the United States Navy. Gayla, to you too, thank you for your service. And she earned an honorable discharge as a senior chief petty officer. After Gayla's naval career, she worked for the Department of Defense in the city of Gainesville, Florida. Gayla is a member of the National Association of Chief Diversity Officers in Higher Education and the Association for Access, Equity, and Diversity. Gayla earned a Bachelor of Science in Workforce Education Training and Development from Southern Illinois University, a Master's in Business Administration from Webster's University, and she is currently completing two doctorates, the first in Leadership Studies at Gonzaga University and the second in Education Ministry Leadership and Education at Capella University. So Irene and Gayla, thank you so much again for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So this first question, as if our readers didn't hear enough about your backgrounds, I didn't know if there was anything about your background or your professional background that you particularly wanted to share with our audience today before we get started on my questions.
I can go first. I think I am a bilingual community organizer for the Idaho Organization of Research Councils, and I think people don't understand some of the work that we do, so I kind of want to explain a little bit of what we do. So we do work around sustainability and clean energy and anything that deals with environmental justice, which we want to make sure we're protecting our land and the environment and being stewards of that land. And so environmental justice entails where we work, play, pray, and play. And it's especially with what I'm doing right now with Mission 2C, which Resource Council is the newest chapter in Canyon County. We're working on farm worker issues, specifically the pesticide poisoning that happened to farm workers last year. So we want to make sure that environmental justice, that people are getting the justice that they need in the environmental realm, which we don't see too often. Like people of color are tend to be ignored in that sector.
Gayla, is there anything you'd like to share with our audience today?
Well, I just would like to say that I'm just very thankful and blessed to be with an organization, Trinity Health, and I'm responsible for the entire Western service area, which is Idaho, Oregon, and Fresno, California. And, it's been very exciting to move the needle on this work of diversity and inclusion in healthcare, because I think with COVID-19, many of us have been... COVID-19 has really highlighted what many of us have known for many years, and that's the disparities in healthcare with regards to racial disparities. COVID-19 has really hit the Hispanic and the Black communities tremendously, and the Indigenous communities now as well. And so I think it's so important for the healthcare organizations to get involved. And if you don't have a diversity, equity, and inclusion program, to definitely get on board with that, because I can't understand how any healthcare system cannot have such a program when you are responsible for patients and then, you have your colleagues there as well. So I'm just very thankful to be with an organization that truly believes and puts their money where their mouth is when it comes to diversity and inclusion.
And I want to thank you both for those additional comments, because of course, so many are suffering in this pandemic, and we know people of color are suffering at a higher disparate rate. And there's a synergy here between some of the environmental issues in those communities and the health outcomes that we see being affected by COVID-19. So I want to thank you both again for bringing that up. Here's another question, and this is one that touches me very deeply in my daily life, professionally and outside of my professional circles. But how many women or women of color do you encounter in your profession? And how many of those women that you encounter are in positions of power?
I can answer. I don't, in Idaho, I don't really encounter many people working in, many women or women of color working in the environmental justice realm. I think that a lot of our organizations are still very white led by those leaders. And we really, I think a lot of these organizations really need to take a deep look and start hiring people who are people of color, who are women of color in these areas. Luckily, where I work at IORC, like they're actually been working at diversity and inclusion and have actually been able, are looking at their hiring practices and where and how they need to hire. So I've been lucky to work in a place where they're really open about that and are trying to make sure that we're reflecting the community and the work that we're doing with the community.
Gayla?
Well, I would just like to add something to what Irene said. I totally agree with what she's saying. And, you know, here in Idaho, I don't know a lot of women in the leadership realms of the work that I do. And I, for the life of me, you know, it will be great one day for leaders to understand that this is a position that definitely needs to be at the leadership table, making those crucial and critical decisions with the rest of the leadership folks. Oftentimes D&I tends to be put on the back burner and is normally the first program to go when that's needed, when it affects, you know, when the bottom line is affected. But not too many here in Idaho at all. The ones that I do know are like myself. We have our own businesses or they work out in the community doing this work. And so not many in the institutions here in this state. And I will say this, the problem is not hiring. You can get us to come here. And I do believe that because we're here. The problem is retaining us once you get us here. That's important because here in this state, if you want leaders of color to come and do this work in the organizations, we have to feel and know that there is a support system and that there's a community as well that's welcoming and inclusive of those of us that are going to come and do this work, because it's all of our responsibility, not just the chief diversity officer, you know, or the person doing the work of diversity and inclusion. It's all of our responsibility to do this work and move the needle on it.
Thank you. And if either of you could sort of, and this is a question that's not on my list, but speak to a little bit more on the retention end in terms of building a coalition as well as part of that retention. And Gayla, I'll go back to you first on this one.
I think with the retention piece, I think the biggest part of what a lot of institutions miss on that is that, it's sad that we're in a day and time where you have to do creative things to get, you know, people of color to come to, you know, states such as Idaho and places where there is not a lot of racial diversity. And I feel that, you know, through sponsorship programs with those leaders of color at the table, that is the number one key to beginning to have a program of sponsorship where those leaders that are at the table that resemble those individuals that the organizations are trying to recruit can see that, you know, that there's someone at that table that looks like them or at that institution, and people will stay. They will. It's the leadership's responsibility, management's responsibility, that when we hire people in, it just doesn't stop there. We have an obligation getting them here, bringing them here and telling them how lovely and beautiful this place, the state is. And, you know, Boise is just a great place to be with friendly people. It requires so much more than that, in my opinion. There has to be a means to show that there's also community, because I want to know, where can I get my hair done? I want to know, where's the church that I can attend? And I also want to know, where's all the ethnic food that I can eat? And so I think a lot of that, I know that a lot of that goes into play when it comes to retention, but more so than anything, support of us Black women at the table from other leaders, as well as the organizations.
Thank you, Gayla. Irene?
Just like Gayla said, I think when you're in an organization, institution, your supervisor, your whoever it is, should be providing that support. There should be a support system for you when you do go through instances of racism or micro or macroaggressions. I think that they need to be open and listen to the fact that sometimes you might be disrespected by certain groups because they are at a different, you know, they don't respect you, they don't see you. And so it's important for, you know, that especially if you're in a small organization or a bigger one, just to make sure that you do support your employee, because that makes people go. That's why people leave, because when people don't feel supported, people will leave. I mean, I was born and raised in Idaho, so I have family here and I have ties here. I mean, honestly, if I didn't have that, I might not be here, you know, but because I am from here, I am still here. And I want to be able to be, you know, do what I need to do to help my community and to help the Latinx community. But I do think it's important that employers, especially supervisors and the staff, support people of color, women of color who are there, and also provide them resources. So that way, if they want to build up an organization to reflect that community, that's there. Because if not, people will leave. And even one thing that might not be that big of a deal is a big deal to many of us.
So one of the questions I have on my list, we've talked a little bit about some of the barriers to being a woman here and a woman of color here in Idaho. How do you feel about how have you achieved success as a woman of color in Idaho? Gayla, we'll start with you on this one.
I can go first. For me, it's been the awesome support from a lot of my colleagues at Boise State that are, you know, still there. Without a lot of them, I don't know how I would have made it, to be quite honest with you. You know, a lot of support in the community from various people, as well as my organization, as I spoke of earlier. You know, that support system is there from our president and CEO of Trinity Health in its entirety, you know, throughout all of our ministries, throughout all of our hospitals. It's echoed and the same. You know, I just think that that support system, I wouldn't be here without it. And I do feel that I have that support from the community and from some of the other organizations as well as my own.
Irene.
Same thing, community, support from family, support from friends, support from my colleagues. I'm lucky that I'm in a job now where I am actually being listened to. Where people are more open. I think if I didn't have that, it would be harder to do the work that I do. And success comes with within community, and community is what keeps us strong. So I look towards my activist community, because I've been doing activism for like 20 years around immigrant rights, because I also do immigrant rights activism, not as much as I used to, but having those networks and those connections has really helped me succeed. And having people like one of my biggest mentors and who got me into this activism realm was Leo Morales, who everyone knows is the ACLU executive director. And he's someone that I credit with a lot of the skills that I have now and helping me do the work I do. And just having people like him in my life and people like just, you know, my friends and my family just really helps me be able to succeed. And just knowing that I'm here to support people and not here to tell people what to do and not tell people how things should be done, but listening to them and knowing how can I help you to succeed also, you know, being that person.
So I'm going to probe you both a little bit more on this question as well. And Irene, I'll start with you. You both sort of describe these outer support networks, which we all know is just so critically important to anyone's development, much less women of color. And especially when you're in sort of a majority, you're the minority in a majority environment. But is there something deeper within you that gives you sort of that impetus, that faith in yourself. Some people call it brown girl magic, black girl magic. I wondered if you could speak a little bit to that. What is it within you that gives you the faith to push through when you have these challenges, or just knowing the challenges ahead of you as a woman of color?
I'll go first. For me, it's my faith. And I'm not afraid to say that. It's my faith because I know that I'm gifted to do this work. And I love to see good seeds planted and what comes after that, because we can't change people. You can't change anyone. But the work that we do is so important that all you can hope is that you do it in the right way, so that even those that are not receptive or are afraid of diversity, equity, inclusion, or say they're ignorant to it or they don't understand it. I just believe that you have to meet people where they are sometimes, even though there are days when you don't want to, because as the Black girl, you know, or the Black woman, you're always the one at the table to have to handle these sort of things. Again, all the weight being on your shoulder, it seems sometimes, but you know, I just think that, you know, we just have to lean on each other. And I cling to my faith to get me through doing this work, because I know that I'm equipped to do it, or I wouldn't be here doing it. And it seems that every institution or organization that I go to is either an inaugural DE&I program, or there's non-existent. Or if there's work being done, there's no structure to that work whatsoever. It's just, you know, all over the place being done. And so I think that you have to find within yourself doing this work and not take things personally, because everybody is not on the same journey. We all have biases as well. And so, you know, you just have to respect and basically show up to gain an understanding, you know, from others. And so that's my approach to this work. I love what I do, simply because I have faith and hope that even today, with the things that we're facing and seeing in our country, that we can make a change as a country, because we have to. But we have to be able to support one another and meet each other where we are, even if we disagree.
Irene.
Well, my parents are from Michoacán, Mexico. They crossed the border. And so I really think about the sacrifices they made and the fact that they risked their life to make sure that their children had a better future than they did. And I mean, I think about that a lot. And the work that I do is because of my parents, and because they're the ones that work so hard to help us get to where we're at. And, you know, and just being able to see my parents smile and say, oh my God, look what you've done, you know. And also, like, my nieces, my nieces and nephews are the future generation. And I think about how can I leave this environment, this world, in a better place for them? And what tools can I give to them to help them on their way? Like, one of my nieces, you know, she's starting to become an activist at 16. You know, she's going to do a lot of work around environmental and racial justice and these things. And so I think about, like, the fact that she looks up to me and sees the things I do, and that makes her proud, you know. And also just community, because there's so many people out there that I hope I'm doing good work for, and that I'm doing it for them and not necessarily for myself. And also, you know, working on myself, because like Gayla says, we're all still learning and we're all still working, and we are all still trying to make sure that we're doing the best that we can at the jobs that we do. So for me, it's really important to also work on myself and not just think that I know everything, because you don't know everything. I think I've gotten to the age where you don't know as much as you think you do. It's life is a learning process, and how you learn is, and how you take it is how things will go. So I really look upon my community as a strength and to help me keep me going.
So I'd like to take this opportunity to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Gayla Thomas Dabney and Irene Ruiz. I am Professor Shakira Sanders, your moderator for this conversation. And I also want to remind our listeners that you can type your questions into the Q&A chat box. I have some that are already coming in. We're just about 15 or 20 minutes away from getting to your questions. So if you have a question, this would be a great time to get it in so that I can properly monitor and make sure that we can get in as many questions as possible. You both talked about things sort of as women of color, sort of being in this position where there's a lot of weight on your shoulder, where you often have to step up. And this leads to my next question, which is oftentimes in my experience, I do feel as if part of what becomes part of my characteristic is that I'm maybe a little bit more courageous than some of my other counterparts or coworkers. And of course, when I use that word courage, I can't help but to think of some of the gender connotations that come with seeing yourself that way. So what I want to know is, how do you sort of deal with some of those gender connotations that come with being someone who carries that weight, who steps up to the plate, who seeks to sort of create this legacy for you and those who are coming after you, being one of those person who's planting those seeds that will allow others to blossom with you and after you? Sort of how do you exercise that power? And where do you find the courage to exercise that power? Irene, do you want to go first on this one?
Sure. That one's a hard one to answer. I think a lot is just I try to make sure I'm assertive, and when I talk that I'm clear and let people understand that this is how I'm feeling. Like, I don't, especially when I'm, you know, it's a lot of the times you can be in a white male dominated, you know, situation, and just make yourself, your presence heard and make yourself feel heard, and just making sure that they understand you. And sometimes you have to learn how to pick your battles too, because sometimes some things are not worth it, and some things you just have to walk away because you also have to take care of yourself. But I'm someone who doesn't go down quietly. A lot of people know me, and I'm someone that's pretty adamant in getting the things that I need to get done for, you know, to support the community and the work that I'm doing. And it's hard. I mean, it just depends on the situation too, and where you're at and what circles you're in as well. I think some are harder than others, and I think some can be very tedious and hard to maneuver. And sometimes I don't have an answer for that. Sometimes it's hard, and it's just, it's a hard thing being a woman, especially a woman of color in certain situations. But all we can do is the best that we can do and use the tools that we have and try to hopefully get our point and our point across. It's kind of a hard question to answer, but.
Gayla?
You know, I think that being a woman in this role, and a Black woman at that, for me, I have no problem. I'm not the person that always shows up and has a problem with that. Oftentimes it's others that have the issue with it, simply because of the color of my skin and because I'm very educated, as well as, you know, if I'm going to call it as it is, because that's the culture I came from. I told you, 24 years in the military, I come from an accountable culture, and we're not a perfect culture, but we do hold people accountable. So a lot of these things that that, you know, I've had to deal with in the course of doing this work, it's my background of that military service that allows me to keep getting up every day and doing this work with courage, because that's what we have to have. And, you know, our core values were honor, courage, and commitment. And it takes courage to do this work. And so I just refuse to give up, you know. And my president and CEO now, you know, she said something very important to me. She's like, the work has to be done, Gayla. You know, somebody has to do it. You know, we, in other words, have to do this work. We cannot give up just because, you know, you have folks that don't believe in this work and they think it's divisive or whatever that may look like, you know. But it takes a lot of courage, and not just for us, but for those people that say they support you. I think with George Floyd and a lot of the things that we've seen with the racial injustice and racial inequality has really kind of shown, you know, I can't speak for Irene, but I know for myself, and I don't know about you, Shakira, but it's really shown me as well, you know, who those supporters are, because a lot of people have been really silent, you know, during this time of everything that's taking place. And I oftentimes say that it's okay to say, you know, and even, you know, especially as a woman, being a woman, that, yeah, I want to get involved. I want to do this. I want to do that, no matter who you are. But when the rubber meets the road and all things happen, such as, you know, what we've seen across our country, you know, what do? Because that's where that model and moral courage comes in, you know? And so just being that woman of faith and being that woman that has that courage, just not being afraid of what this work entails, you know, and to take it head on. And so that's what helps me, again, my faith.
And I want to thank you both. As you said, Irene, that is an incredibly difficult question. And to sort of answer your question, Gayla, I agree. For myself, there is a sense of just inner courage that I really try to tap into. I see it as part of the spiritual legacy of my ancestors who were born in bondage and slavery, and civil rights activists. Just personally, I know my future was set by generations before me. I received a college scholarship in eighth grade from a civil rights activist in Michigan, where I grew up in Detroit, who happened to be an attorney. And look at me, I'm a law professor. And so when you think about, and of course, in eighth grade, I wasn't thinking, oh yeah, I guess I'm going to be a law professor. And it's amazing to me now to think about how that legacy lives on. I'll just also say this, I discovered that there are other parts to yourself that you learn to discover. My family and I are sort of launching this new initiative to sort of trace our birthdays back to significant events. So I discovered my birthday was one of the last significant Civil War battles before Lee surrendered. And I have found in the last year since I've discovered that how inspired I've been to know that there is that connection. So I want to thank you both for tapping into that very personal part of yourselves with that audience. And that last question certainly was not one that was on my list. So I want to pivot a little bit to one of the questions that we got in the Q&A, because I think it actually fits with where our discussion is right now. And the question is this: in this time of growing polarization, do you find that you are seeing an increase in overt racism? And Gayla, we'll start with you and then pivot to Irene.
Over racism? The pivot I see and have seen over these last few months and during COVID, I will say, has been very shocking to me, to say the least, simply because, again, you know, I raised my hand and I voluntarily, you know, agreed to serve my country and protect the citizens of the United States. Never did I think that in my young years, I would retire from the military just to be a civilian, to have to watch what I see abroad oftentimes in the war times that I've served in. Never thought I would see us as a country fighting one another still over race. And until we address this thing of race, I don't see how we can move forward. We have to address it as a nation. We have to hear one another, and we have to be able to move on from this, because it just makes us vulnerable to others right now. So, yeah, it's been hard during these times to watch the racism. And I think it's also forced a lot of people to take a look within themselves as well, you know, to also face our biases, you know, and to face some of the things that maybe some thought they had, you know, gotten over or didn't possess. I think a lot of these things that are going on in our country have brought forth a lot of different things that we haven't seen come to light, but we know that they've been going on continuously behind the scenes.
For me, it's the type of stuff my grandmother and great grandmother used to tell me about.
Exactly. The kind of stuff that I never thought that I would have to sit back and watch, you know, all of it transpire and just all the bickering and back and forth and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And it just makes me think about, you know, and I, again, I'll talk about my faith because I work in a faith-based organization. It takes me back to a place where, you know, who are we to be judging one another for all of these things, our race and all those kind of things, when, you know, many believers say, I love God, but you say you love God, but how can you not love your brother or your sister? And so that's what I struggle with this whole entire thing. And yes, it's going back to my spiritual roots of my ancestors.
Sorry, Irene.
There is more overt racism. It's more pronounced because people feel more free because there's someone that is letting them have that pass. I don't want to call it a pass, but they're seeing that, right? So they feel more open to that. I mean, I don't think I've met anyone who hasn't, especially a person of color, who hasn't dealt with some kind of form of racism, overt racism. Also, I think within the Latinx community, we have a lot of work to do, especially those of us who are non-Black Latinx. We really need to work on our anti-Blackness and our, you know, and we can also be very anti-Indigenous. So I think there's a lot of work for non-Black Latinx people to really, you know, help other non-Black Latinx to understand that their anti-Blackness is not okay, and that we cannot support, we cannot do the work if we're not addressing our own, like Gayla said, our own biases and our own anti-Blackness, because that's a huge thing within my community. And that's something that we just really need to work on and really need to get, you know, help each other and then, you know, be able to support, you know, Black Lives Matter movement and things like that. And the only way we could do that is if we can start working on our own biases as well.
Yeah, Irene, and I really want to thank you for that, because I know for me on this issue in terms of overt racism, I'll be honest and say I think post 9/11 is when I started to feel something was off on the issue of racism and bias. And I say that as someone who grew up in a Muslim household. And so some of the rhetoric around Muslims that began at that time really concerned me, and to see the arc of it in the past two decades has really been startling to find myself sort of here. But I will say that I've tried to use some of this time to become more aware of Indigenous issues in Indigenous communities and issues in our undocumented communities, particularly our farm working communities, where for far too long individuals and their lives have been treated as invisible. And I say that because this kind of leads me to my next question, which is, sometimes I feel as a woman of color, despite my education, despite my profile, despite my profession, I feel this bit extremely visible in some situations and completely invisible in other situations. And I wonder if you felt that type of duality. And if you have, how would you describe your ability to navigate this duality of feeling sort of in some situations very visible, very in the spotlight, and other situations just completely invisible or unnoticed, unheard?
Well, I'll go first on that. I'll just say that for me, the invisible is hurtful. The invisible dismisses the person. The invisible says that you're not wanted at the table. The invisible refuses to acknowledge what you're bringing to the table. And, you know, that's a hard place to be when you've been put in a situation as such. But again, I think it takes a sort of a person, a special kind of person, in my opinion, to do this work. And being a woman, you know, in itself, and those things that you come up against as well, you know, when you are in a male dominated place or organization where some folks may not feel like women have a right at the table or belong at the table, or treat, you know, them as being invisible. And, you know, that's not a good feeling at all. I feel that the visible comes when there's things like what's going on today in this world. And that's when we're asked to be visible. We're asked to be there. We're asked to be present. We're asked to help. We're asked to do all of these things when these types of things happen, such as what we see in our country. But it should be on the forefront of everyone's minds all the time with regards to working collaboratively with folks that are in the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion, just moving the needle to make the organization a more inclusive and welcoming environment without making anyone feel invisible, because we all should be felt and seen and heard.
And of course, there's the aspect of invisibility or visibility, I guess, but really invisibility, that's sort of where you're not even approached. And there's that other aspect where you're kind of approached, but then no one really cares what you have to say, right? And it can happen in both ways. And I think you bring up a good point in sometimes how women of color are really sought out in times of crisis, right? When it's all gone into a handbag, then you're sort of there to clean up. But in times of peace, right? It's that invisibility in that time. Irene?
Depends what spaces you're in. I mean, sometimes I'll be in spaces where it's mostly white led, very upper class people where I'm pretty much invisible and they don't respect me and they don't see me. And they say they hear me, but they really don't, because then you turn around the next meeting you're at, they do the same thing. So you're like, okay, you're really not seeing me and you're really not understanding. And they're also dismissive if they create, like they make some kind of comment that can be very racist, that can be over, you know, I don't want to say that can be very harmful to that person, and they gloss over it or they deflect and they blame other people or they blame someone else because, oh, well, that's not what I meant. Or I understand that we're all learning. I do. And we're all at different places in life. But if you're not addressing the harm and you're not apologizing for that harm, you're going to keep making people of color, women of color, invisible. That's just going to be it. Like, if you're just going to gloss it over and pretend that didn't exist, you're not acknowledging it. And you're not really working in trying to be inclusive and trying to be equitable at all. And I see that, you know, in certain groups that I'm in. And also there's spaces where we have to, you know, we don't want to be the token, you know, like the next one. We don't want to be the token Black woman. We shouldn't be tokens. And that's what happens in a lot of organizations, especially right now where the people are doing DEI work, diversity, equity, inclusion work. They look at that person of color who's in that place and be like, hey, can you help us? Like, I'm not your token. I'm not here to further your agenda. I'm here to support that community that needs the help in what we're doing, not to make your group. I'm not saying this about my work, but I'm just saying in certain instances, right? I'm not here to make your organization look better. I'm not here to be your token person that you can like show off and be like, oh, look, of all the work we've done. I mean, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And if you want us to really be visible, you need to respect us and show that you actually care and acknowledge when you do harm. If not, you're going to keep, you know, erasing us from everything.
I think that's so important what you just said, Irene, because it's the not acknowledging and it's the blind spots where, and oftentimes, you know, it's just no longer good enough to say, I'm ignorant to that because I believe that at some point in time in one's career path, the higher up you get, the better informed that you should be, because you can't have a team and you try to, if you can't speak to your team to bring them together as a team when it comes to issues of race matters, race relations and things like that, then those folks are going to look at you like, what's going on? No matter what your race is, they want answers and they want help. And the one individual that does the DE&I work is not going to always be there, you know, because there's other places that they have to be as well. And so that's why I keep going back to the fact and saying that this is a role and responsibility for everyone, you know, to come to the table and do this work and to just acknowledge us as women and that we are qualified and are capable of doing many different jobs and taking on many different roles, but sometimes they're not given that opportunity to do so.
I'd like to thank you both for your answers to that question. And I'd like to take this time again to remind our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Gayla Thomas-Dabney and Irene Ruiz. I am your moderator, Shakira Sanders. So I'm going to pivot to another one of our audience questions, which is, and I'll preface this by saying, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this concept of intersectionality, this idea that we are not just people of color, not just women, that we're women of color. And I often get the sort of, how do you feel as a woman, or how do you feel as a woman of color, as if there's some way to split myself and separate and only speak as a woman versus, or only speak as an African-American woman, or as opposed to an African-American woman of color, or a woman who is African-American. And so here, this question is, you know, what are the challenges that you face that are different for you as a woman of color as opposed to a person of color? And I'll add on to that question as in the context of this question, I'll add on one of the questions I prepared, which is, and does intersectionality speak to your experience as a woman and woman of color?
I can start.
All right, and that's another tough question. So
yeah,
my apology.
Honestly, it's funny. I feel like some people think we're one-dimensional people. We're not. We're multi-layered individuals, and I wish people would really see that we are multi-layered, and that we do fit in different intersections in our work and the things that we do. You know, we do work thinking about those intersections that we do live in, right? Because for me, I'm a woman of color. Also, my background is Mexican, my parents are immigrants. So there's a lot of layers. I was a farm worker, you know, I've done all these things. So there's so many layers to me that help me do my work and help me do what I need to do for the community, and use those as an advantage, right? Use those as a way to be able to help those that need to be helped. And so I think it's important for people to acknowledge that we are more than just what we look, that we have a lot of layers, and we can be also complex as well, and that we are all trying to achieve success by using these intersectionalities. I hope I'm answering that okay, but it's one of those like really, really good questions.
Gayla?
I'll just use this analogy because for the life of me, I just don't understand why it's not this simple. And it just has to do, you kind of said it earlier, Shakira. Again, I come from a culture most of my life where when I go to war, I'm an American. Nobody looks at the color of my skin. No one asks me what my religion is. No one is going to ask me about my gender or sexual orientation when I'm on the front line in a wartime situation. The bottom line is when the enemy comes for you, they're coming for you as an American person. They could care less about any of the other tangibles that go with it. And so, you know, that's the best way that I can. I think if we take so much emphasis, we know that there's a history. We know that there are things that have happened, you know, in this country. Everyone knows it. It's written in history. It's all there. But at what point in time, you know, can we come together as a nation and realize that we are all Americans? That's the bottom line at the end of the day. And so all this other stuff that's taking place and that's going on, and all the injustice and the inequalities and all those things, you know, they've just been very hurtful to watch and experience. Because at the end of the day, if we were invaded tomorrow, no one is going to care about these things that we're fighting about in our country. That's the best way that I can put that out there.
Thank you. Thank you both. And so my next question is one from our audience too, which is this. Last year, our legislature removed affirmative action policies from state law by claiming that the best way to address racism is to stop talking about race. And I'll just say this, there was a statute passed by the Idaho legislature last year that prohibited a consideration of race and gender specifically when it comes to hiring and employment, university admissions, that sort of thing around the state of Idaho. I've certainly felt as if in my professional life, that new statute has been used as a way to say, hey, we can't talk about race or racial impacts. How do you feel about these type of laws that sort of regulate in this way? And I understand neither one of you are lawyers, so I'm certainly not asking for a legal opinion, but I do wonder how would a law like this affect you in the work that you do?
Well, I have an affirmative action background. I've been doing affirmative action for probably over 20 years. I believe in affirmative action because of the things that have happened in our history. And what just boggles my mind is that when we say women, we're talking about women of all races. I mean, think about how long it took for women just to have the right to vote. And some days you feel like that's still, you know, something that you know, folks may want to try to take away from you. But I think that the program works if it's administered correctly and if people are educated on what affirmative action truly is. And when I read that last year, when that happened here, I will just tell you that I was just really kind of shocked about that, because if you think that being in a state where you already have less than what 0.4% of Blacks in the state, if you think that doing away with affirmative action is going to make that all equaled out and you know, you're going to have Black folks running all throughout your organization, that's not going to happen, because when you have bias, implicit bias involved in the hiring processes themselves, you're going to have problems with getting racial diversity in your organization. And so that's the reason why affirmative action is into law. It not only protects minorities, it protects women of all races, veterans, and disabled persons. And that's based on the history of the discrimination that the law has said that has occurred, you know, throughout history of time. I didn't pick those four categories. The law said that these are the protected categories for affirmative action. But when you hear people say, we're just going to hire for talent, to me, that's just another way to say we're going to continue to remain white, because that's exactly what's going to happen. And I just couldn't believe that, you know, if you're getting any kind of federal monies, how can you not have an affirmative action program? And if you are getting those federal monies, where are the dollars going if you don't have an affirmative action program that expands its net of recruiting out there to recruit from a variety of diversity resources?
And of course, there's certainly the dual concern that you won't be checking to see what's going on in your organization. And so any organization that seeks to use this law as a way to ignore racism or sexism or homophobia or whatever at their institutions may certainly find themselves on the wrong side of federal rules. Yeah. And so that's a lot of what I think about being at an institution where there is a fair amount of reported racism at that institution in terms of the student experience. Irene, I want to pivot to you on this question.
Yeah, that was upsetting to see that happened, especially because we are in a state where the minority is, you know, is very small. And not being able to have those protections to protect people, it's going to make it easier for organizations, corporations, whatnot, to discriminate, even though they claim that this law was discriminatory in itself, which is not. I mean, I think it's the lack of education, that people not really understanding what affirmative action means and what it actually does. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation, and I think that's the problem, is that people are just not well informed on what a law like this does, because they think it's something that is racist, and it's not. Like, and people don't even understand the power structure of what racism is. So yeah, of course it's easy for them to say it's a racist law, and it's not. We all know it's not. And, you know, and to think that this was a white woman who brought this law about, it was, you know, that I'm sure she, I can't say anything, but I'm sure you know, she could have benefited from, right? And so I think the lack of knowledge is what needs to, people need to be more informed on what this really means. And it was sad to see that. And it's also sad to see, like, we're seeing a lot of other laws too in our state legislature that are discriminatory that have been passed. So.
Well, I certainly, attended one of the sessions for that particular law. I think there was actually only one session, or I think in one of the chambers, I attended one of the sessions. And I found it very interesting, just the language of the statute, the way it does single out race and gender. And if you look at other similar statutes that ban sort of those considerations, there's a whole list that includes many more categories. So I do wonder how a challenge to Idaho's statute would shake out either in federal or state court. So we'll see if someone ultimately brings a lawsuit over that.
Well, it just really baffles me that, you can't dismiss having the conversations on race. And affirmative action does not say that you have to hire someone based on the color of their skin, their gender, disability or veteran status. It says hire the best qualified candidate, for the position. However, if there is an affirmative action goal and you have an opportunity in that particular category of job positions, then you should definitely, if the person is qualified, you should want to hire them in to increase the racial diversity within your organization. And I just, I just think that to do away with something like that speaks volumes to minorities, and it should speak volumes to the women who have told me that, there's typically normally just, a certain demographic in the leadership positions here in the state. And to me, it would seem like a lot of people would be concerned about this, because it to me, there is a concern, and I'm a veteran as well. So, to do away with that, that also tells our vets who are protected categories of that program, what does that say to our vets as well?
So we've got a few more minutes left, and I wanted to give you both a chance to offer any final thoughts before I wrap up. Irene, would you like to go first?
Again, thank you for allowing me to have this space to speak about my experience on racism and working in the organization I work with. I think it's important to people to acknowledge the work that is going on, and that there are women in color in environmental justice realms who are doing the work in Idaho. And also, I think it's important for us to realize that sometimes, at the end of the day, we're all still learning, and sometimes we mess up, and sometimes we gotta learn how to collect ourselves and get up and do the best we can next time. But as long as we're learning and we're not making the same mistakes over and over again, and we're willing to be open to being called, called out and things like that, I think that that's what really matters, is just being able to learn as we grow. And also that also helps support the work that we do.
Gayla.
I would just like to say to, just if nothing else, to take away the fact that we're all on different journeys on this, in this walk of diversity, equity, inclusion. Folks are all on different journeys as well when it comes to, unpacking bias and where you stand with regards to that word racism or racist. But I think that we all should remember at the end of the day that we're all Americans, and we should show empathy, compassion, and most importantly, we have to maintain our integrity even when people are not watching, because people are always going to be watching to see how you handle a certain situation and how you show up. And I would just say that being a Black woman, I'm going to show up all the time for my white friends or anyone else. And so all I would ask is that that same thing be extended to me in any capacity. And for women, I would say this, I would leave you with this note, that we don't have to fill anyone's shoes but our own, because we were made that way. I think that we are some beautiful beings that can do anything and many things, multitasking and all of those things. And I just say that because I had a captain tell me when I was the first woman on board a combatant ship that I needed to fill my predecessor's shoes because there had never been any women on board the ship. And I just looked at him and said, no, sir, I don't have to fill his shoes at all. he definitely couldn't feel mine. And so I never had an issue with him ever again, you know, trying to demean me because I was a woman. And so I just leave us with that. We should be helping each other up, not pulling each other down. And thank you.
Well, I wanna thank you both, and I'll leave our audience with this. And I think this sort of goes with some of the things today. About a year and a half ago, I was on my way back from Idaho, and it was the end of my sabbatical. So I was actually moving back to Idaho, having been away for almost a year. And I was in line at the airport, and there was, of course, a lot going through my head, being away from home for so long. And of course, the time away really solidified to me that Idaho had become home in my head. And I was at the airport, and per usual, I was running a little late, and the line, security line was very long, partially because there was a veterans group who had just completed a tour of the U.S. Capitol. I was coming from D.C., and they were headed back to Oregon, which I could tell from their T-shirts. And so, you know, as we were sort of all sitting there, waiting there in this very long line, all getting very sort of annoyed, I sort of started to chat up these veterans. I saw that their T-shirt set with Lamet. So I said, oh, great wine. You know, you don't always see a lot of Pacific Northwesterners when you're traveling around the country, especially East. But either way, I just remember, again, feeling so much on my mind coming back home. And as the line began to move, and I was sort of, we were sort of advancing, one of the individuals I was standing next to began to sing the Idaho State song to me. And he just had this beautiful voice. And these were very old vets, by the way, senior citizens. And as I was walking to my gate, you know, I felt a lot of that angst about returning to Idaho start to make sense. I knew I was going to be making a lot of big decisions when I got back and facing some huge hurdles, and I needed a lot of courage. And yet here is this group of senior citizen veterans, old white men, sort of singing me off to my flight as if I'm going off to battle somehow. And I thought, yeah, this is like, you know, this is it, right? This is it. This is why I'm coming back home. This is the right thing to do, hearing that song at that time. And so I say that just to inspire all of our listeners that tough things, sometimes you don't know if you can do them, and strangers can be the one. Of course, thinking about those vets as I do now on every Veterans Day, in addition to thinking about my grandfather and my cousins who've served, it does remind me that in this country, we're connected. And we're connected by our legacy and our history of racism, sexism, homophobia. And it's up to all of us to just take one step forward. And so one thing that I've been doing is sort of a land acknowledgement. So I want to leave us tonight or this afternoon with a personal acknowledgement that I'm an African-American woman on Native American land. And I want to thank my guest today for joining me in this space to continue to discuss these super important topics. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.